From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There is, at the moment, no shooting war in Ukraine. Russia's annexation of Crimea has till now been accomplished with negligible resistance. There is, however, a full-blown propaganda war in progress, waged by the Kremlin with eerily familiar weapons of mass deception. Big lies.
Putin claimed Ukrainians are living in terror.
And staged incidents.
Among the pro-Russian protests in Ukraine, growing evidence of protest tourists.
All playing to what for Russians is a resonant historical truth.
In an emotional speech, Putin said Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has always been an integral part of Russia in the hearts and minds of people.
While Western audiences may dismiss Vladimir Putin's fabrications as transparent and even primitive, the majority of Russians have embraced Russia's annexation of Crimea as a historic rescue mission. Michael Idov, editor-in-chief of GQ Russia, says the blunt propaganda tactics are intended to bolster one master narrative that's been building for years.
It's basically Russia as a besieged fortress, beset on all sides by enemies. Once you've established that, all you need to prove is that the people who came to power in Ukraine are fascists, and fascist is the scariest of the scary words for the Russian psyche, which is still heavily scarred by World War II. And then that immediately becomes a pretext for liberating the Crimeans from the terrible fascist regime established in Kiev. I sound like I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. I'm reading an official statement by the Russian Foreign Ministry that calls what happened in Kiev a Nazi coup.
Now, here in the West, we have seen reported no evidence of violence against ethnic Russians or any kind of the siege that the Kremlin is describing. Have any such episodes been reported that seem credible to you?
There have been a few skirmishes, but here's the scary part. We now have a chicken and egg problem, because if you introduce vehement anti-Ukrainian sentiment and you rile up the population this way through mass media and then introducing rumors and staging events, then that leads to a very real and actually grassroots anti-Russian sentiment, which does create the situations that you then have to react against. So it's an incredibly dangerous game that they're playing.
On Russian TV, for example, and in Russian newspapers, has there been any counter-narrative or any evidence of an internal debate?
Well, there's no room left for the other side of the story, because we're in the midst of a very swift and very effective removal of all dissent from mass media. A couple of weeks ago, Lenta, one of the leading, if not the leading, independent online news resources, lost its editor-in-chief, and a Kremlin flunky has been put in her place. And the only remaining independent TV channel, Dorst or Rain TV, has been told that their lease is not going to be renewed. There's no platform for any real conversation about the propriety of this other than Facebook and Twitter, which are miraculously still open.
I'm wondering how various sections of the Russian population are processing all of this. Some of the Kremlin's representations are transparent lies, beginning, I guess, with the soldiers without any insignias on their uniforms showing up in Crimea and Putin denying any knowledge of them. What's a Russian to think?
Well, if you know the way the Russian mind operates, it's not really about the rule of law. It's about the spiritual truth or truthiness in Stephen Colbert terms. And the truthiness of this situation is that the Crimea has historically been Russian, and most Russians are ecstatic to receive it back through whatever means. You know, it's about restoring Russia's greatness. You can see it in the skyrocketing approval rating that Putin is enjoying right now. Not all of this is because of this disinformation campaign. People are also happy to see Russia throw its weight around. Unfortunately, it's been so infantilized and condescended to in the 90s that the Russians are ecstatic to be the bully. They love it.
But if it's all shadow puppetry, The Russian people, no matter how humiliated they may feel about 20th century wrongs, they're not stupid. Can they not see through what is being paraded before them?
People don't tend to see through lies when lies support the biases that they already hold. And this is true not only for Russians, that's true for everyone. That's true for the Americans when we went to war with Iraq. Here, I need to point out that there is very real and very authentic pro-Russian sentiment in the Crimea and eastern Ukraine. A lot of what you've been seeing has, in fact, been championed by people on both sides of the border. What's amazing is that the average Russian who's cheering the return of the great empire, Alaska is next. This is one of their favorite, you know, jokes that's not quite a joke. What's amazing is that they don't quite understand that an average Russian does not gain anything from it. The only thing that already has changed is all this commotion has proved ruinous to the ruble. The dollar and the euro are trading incredibly high right now. And so for a country that imports most of its consumer goods, most of the things in stores have already appreciated by 15% or more. So that's something that's going to hit the Russians pretty hard. And that's the price you pay for the return to the supposed theoretical imperial greatness.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Michael Idov is editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. He spoke to us from Moscow.
Michael McFaul has just returned to Stanford University after a couple of tumultuous years in Moscow as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. He said he often encountered the media trope that America, the enemy, was working within the Russian state. In fact, at times it got personal.
The main theme was the United States of America seeks to overthrow the government of Russia. They could say the State Department, Gosdep, as we were called, is funding the opposition. And we said 200,000 times, we are not funding the opposition. So they put out a calendar called McFaul's Girls, and each January, February, March featured one of these opposition leaders that were McFaul's Girls. The Arab Spring, if you just watched Russian television, the gentleman who put himself on fire in Tunisia, that was an American plot. All the way through the Arab Spring, the citizens of those countries had nothing to do with it. It was the United States, the CIA, running covert operations to make that happen. And most certainly inside Ukraine, this was all instigated by us.
You are calling for the United States to answer Russian propaganda in a big and blatant way. What do you suggest?
Well, this view comes from my experience as ambassador for 2 years. We tried to do battle with it through my Twitter account, on Facebook, through interviews for those outlets that could have me. I was banned from state media. And I engaged with my staff in debate with Russian citizens all over that giant country, and I thought it was great. But it felt like dropping pebbles in the ocean. I think during earlier eras, we took this more seriously. I do not believe in propaganda, but I do believe in telling accurate information and getting that information out there. And we're just as a government not putting resources into it. I saw the ratings for my country in Russia peak at about 62-65%, I believe, in 2010. To now creeping in the teens, and our policy didn't change. What changed was the editorial direction of those Russian state-controlled media outlets.
Here's a theme that's been frequently struck in the American media. You hear it a lot from Republicans who are featured on the news.
A critical reason for Putin's aggression has been President Obama's weakness.
People are looking at Putin as one who wrestles bears and drills for oil. They look at our president as one who wears mom jeans.
This is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous. I'm sorry, I can't think of a better phrase. I mean, you know, George W. Bush failed to prevent Russia from intervening in Georgia. Ronald Reagan, he failed to prevent the martial law orchestrated in Poland by General Jaruzelski and Leonid Brezhnev. General President Eisenhower, 1956, his policy was called rollback of communism. He had some very tough language, and when tanks rolled into Budapest in 1956, that tough language totally disappeared. They were unable to deter Russian aggression. Democrat, Republican, strong, weak. Oh, I left out Johnson, of course, Czechoslovakia, 1968. I don't see a particular pattern here that suggests, you know, one kind of president provokes Russian aggression more than the other.
But you don't discount the importance of personality.
I actually, now having been in government for 5 years, believe this even more strongly, that individuals do matter. And in this case, there's no doubt in my mind. This is Putin's war.
You said he was angry when he got back into power after he switched jobs with his handpicked president, Dmitry Medvedev.
Well, Putin, in his first two terms, had a narrative from his perspective and from many Russians' perspective. At the time he came to power, in his view, the state was collapsing. The economy had not recovered from the worst economic depression probably in Russia's history. And Russia was on its knees vis-a-vis the West. And in the first 8 years that he was in power, he restored the state. He cracked down on the breakaway Republic of Chechnya, as you'll remember. The Russian economy grew on his watch. I personally think the economic growth had way more to do with oil prices, but it happened on his watch. He gets credit for it. That was his narrative, right? And he left with that narrative when he handed over power to Medvedev. When he came back, that narrative wasn't good enough for the most educated, elite, rich people of Russia. It was like, what are you going to do now? And that agitated him, in my view, just watching him as I was ambassador. And then second, there were massive demonstrations to protest the falsified December 2011 parliamentary elections. And that was scary for President Putin and his entourage. And so that's when he decided to crack down on the demonstrators and civil society and the independent media on the one hand, and then to create this new enemy from abroad, the United States of America, to roll out that bag of tricks again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Michael McFaul served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 until just last month. So Putin reclaimed Crimea as part of Russia on Tuesday. Certainly novelist David Besmozgis is among those most closely following those developments. For several years, he's worked on a novel set in present-day Crimea, which was, until recently, relatively unknown to his American friends. But now, for the first time since Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt met in Yalta to divide up post-war Europe, Crimea is headline news. His forthcoming novel, The Betrayers, was intended to be set in 2011, then 2012, then 2013, and finally August 2014. But as he sits in the purgatory between manuscript lock and book release, the novelist wrote a blog post in The New Yorker about how he's struggling to update or adjust a fictional story set in a fraught, factual place. David, welcome to On the Media.
Hi.
So tell me about the various stages you went through when Crimea suddenly became super relevant. Kind of like the five stages of grief, although some of them, at least the first one, was pretty triumphant in a way.
Well, precisely. I mean, the place to most people is quite obscure. The irony is that obscure places get into the news only when bad things happen to them, which seemed like, in a way, a stroke of luck for me. For instance, I'm speaking to you on the radio, and I don't think that normally would happen about Crimea.
So your second stage was essentially concern and fear, and you were a little shocked.
Yes. I imagine the people that I know there and worried about them.
And then the third stage.
Well, the third stage was a type of apprehension that I'd had from the very moment that I launched this project. Part of the appeal for writing this book was to take on the challenge that the things that the novel would be talking about were things that were still urgent for people in the present moment, and the novel would become part of that conversation. And I always worried that current events would outpace what I was writing. It takes a long time to write a novel, in this instance, about 3 to 4 years. And if you want it to be current, the chances are that the world will change. And so you take that risk.
Can you take me a little through your thinking and your process as you were watching the violence unfold, your awareness that things weren't going to be the same again?
All the way through, I kept hoping that I could somehow retain this construct where the action could still take place in the summer of 2014. You know, when the protests started in the Maidan, nobody really could see that it would go quite this far, and you thought there might be a settlement. And I thought, okay, if there's a settlement, that I can make some small changes to the manuscript just to acknowledge that this thing had happened in Kyiv, but that ultimately there was no change, that the same sort of pessimism that characterizes Eastern European and Soviet people would just persist. It started to be clear that that was less and less plausible.
So what are you going to do? Your publisher told you that you could make changes, and we're talking about really minor changes, up until June 2014. That's not very far away. Do you put the date that the novel begins back? I mean, you can't start over.
That's right. And before Yanukovych fled and before the Russians seized Crimea, I still thought, well, if the election happens in Kyiv at the end of May and things are more or less stable, maybe I could still do what I'd planned from the very beginning. But that's clearly not possible anymore. And so I think the only choice is to take it back, let's say, to the summer of 2013, which is something I resisted all along for other reasons that have to do with the novel that are just too convoluted to get into here. But it seemed like the lesser of two evils.
I don't want to get into cliche here, but the question has to be asked. We're flooded with information now, 24-hour news cycle, on and on. Do you think that the novel can really speak to contemporary events?
Well, it's difficult. And the question is, does digital technology enable the publishing industry to do something of the sort? Maybe not in every instance, maybe not.
But why can't it just hurry the heck up?
Well, most of it has to do with marketing and publicity and the time it takes to do that, to put a catalog together.
Okay, so it seems that the schedule at many publishers is out of step with our times. Let me quote from the end of the blog post you wrote in The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
You said, does all this that you've been going through and all the challenges of this fast-paced information environment render the pursuit of a novel with political ambition a fool's errand? And if it does, what's the cultural cost?
The blog post answers the question because it goes on to say what the difference is between a work of journalism, which is made of facts, and a work of fiction, which is an imaginative and moral leap from atop those facts. You can put yourself into it and you can debate whether this was right or this was wrong, if it conforms with the world as you believe it to be or not. Whereas a work of journalism, you really can't do that because you know that it's based on fact and therefore it is what it is. The experience for the reader and so the experience for the culture is different in that you can become personally involved in this world rather than standing and watching it objectively. It comes down to a question of empathy and identification. And if we're no longer able to do that, if the novel is no longer able to do that, then I think it is a great cultural loss.
David, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David Besmozgis is a writer and filmmaker. His novel, The Betrayers, will be published by Little Brown and Company on September 23rd, no matter what happens.
Coming up, the NSA says not to worry. It can't learn much about us from the metadata it's been collecting. Turns out, you should probably worry.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When Edward Snowden first revealed the NSA's controversial surveillance program last year, much of the NSA's defense of the practice relied on the fact that they were only collecting metadata and therefore weren't actually spying on Americans. Here is NSA Chief Keith Alexander talking last year to John Miller on 60 Minutes.
You don't hear the call.
You don't hear the call.
You don't see the name.
You don't see the names.
You just see this number called that number.
This number, the to from number, the duration of the call and the date time group. That's all you get.
So just numbers, phone numbers, time numbers, length numbers, no real privacy concerns, right? Wrong, at least according to computer scientists at Stanford University, who argue that phone metadata is inherently revealing and have conducted their own simulation of the NSA's metadata collection to prove it. Jonathan Mayer is a PhD student at Stanford and has been working on the project at Stanford Security Lab.
We made an application available to users of Android smartphones that would enable them to upload their own phone metadata to us for analysis. The first step in analyzing the data was mapping numbers to names, names of organizations, names of professional services, names of individuals. And we were able to do that pretty easily. There are a number of public databases you can use, from Yelp, from Google, from Facebook. We categorized the types of organizations that individuals called, and we found a number of fairly sensitive groups in there.
The law permits the NSA to also track the contacts of the numbers that have been dialed, right? This is called a hop.
That's right. So, for example, if I called you, the NSA could make a hop over to your phone metadata. Under old rules, the NSA could follow three hops in phone metadata. Newer rules constrain the agency to two. One of our findings was that two or three hops can be sufficient to reach a substantial proportion of the United States population by virtue of very popular phone numbers. So, for example, you may have called FedEx. I certainly have called FedEx. That means we're two hops away from each other.
I want to return to the idea of what inferences the intelligence agencies can actually draw. You began with simply trying to figure out people's romantic relationships. You were also able to predict religious affiliation, financial problems, legal issues, a lot.
That's right. A participant in our study who owns a specific brand and model of assault rifle. That was identifiable based on a pattern of calls to local firearm dealers and national customer service lines for a particular firearm manufacturer.
You found at least one criminal?
A participant in our study placed calls to a lumber yard and a locksmith, local hydroponics dealers, and a bong shop. The inference, I think, is pretty obvious.
This person was setting up a marijuana grow house, as far as you can tell. And someone else ended a pregnancy.
That was a plausible inference from someone who had a lengthy early morning phone call with someone we were able to identify as her sister, followed by some calls with the local Planned Parenthood location, and then some calls a couple weeks later, and then a call a month after that. That pattern of calls certainly gives rise to an inference.
In terms of privacy of the individual, ordinary American, I guess it almost doesn't matter whether the inferences made from this metadata are accurate or inaccurate.
I would agree. Plausible inferences drawn from data, even inaccurate ones, can have a great impact. For example, in the consumer privacy space, one great concern is false inferences getting drawn that might lead to a bad credit score. In fact, we hear about that all the time in the news. Information derived from phone metadata could be used to build a case against an individual to justify later searches of an individual's communications or even their home or physical possessions.
Do you have any reason to believe that the NSA is, in fact, using the metadata to make educated guesses about individual behavior? Or is this just a researcher's parlor game?
We can't be certain, of course, of what individual NSA analysts do with the information at their disposal. However, I'm not sure it really matters. The agency has tried to defend its practices on the basis that these programs don't allow for very sensitive inferences about ordinary Americans. That claim is contradicted by the science. Metadata appears to be highly sensitive, and certainly privacy risks arise from the availability of this sort of information, whether or not it's actually used that way.
And if they weren't doing it yesterday, in all probability, thanks to you, they will be doing it tomorrow.
I hope not.
Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Mayer is a PhD candidate in computer science at Stanford University. His metadata research is a project of the Stanford Security Lab. The first word on this week's L.A. earthquake was probably delivered by the morning news team at KTLA Channel 5, who felt the tremor and ducked under their anchor desk.
Thank you. Coming up, more problems for a troubled
earthquake.
Theater.
Yep, we're having an earthquake.
But the first reporter to write the story was fearless because it was an algorithm. Specifically, it was a program called QuakeBot, which harvested data from the U.S. Geological Survey alerts and then spun it into text. That allowed the L.A. Times to release news of the quake faster than any other media outlet. The Times later updated the story using human journalists, but the scoop was undeniably robotic. Nick Diakopoulos, a Tau fellow at Columbia Journalism School, says experimenting with automated reporting is a growing trend in the newsroom.
I know the LA Times also has a bot that collects homicide data and tries to generate stories based on that. There's another project out of Temple University where they're looking at education data that's been scraped about public schools and trying to sort of generate snippets of stories.
Is it belaboring the obvious to ask what's the advantage for publishers to use bot-generated reporting?
I mean, I think the hope is that these techniques won't put people out of a job, but they'll sort of increase the entire size of the pie in terms of the content that gets generated, and also increase the ability for publishers to cover stories that might not have been covered otherwise.
Okay, so far it's all thumbs up, but as algorithms increasingly intrude into areas arbitrated by human beings, what else should we be concerned about?
When you have an algorithm that's generating content for you, what are the editorial biases of that algorithm? Could that algorithm be censoring something or filtering it or emphasizing a particular aspect of a story through the way it's programmed? So that's one thing to be wary of. Another thing is having some transparency for the provenance of the data that's driving these algorithmic content generators. So I think what was interesting about the QuakeBot at the LA Times is that at the bottom of the story, it said very clearly, this story was created by an algorithm written by the author of this story. And that label also mentioned that the data came from the USGS. You know, by telling people where the data came from, it gives them an extra sort of signal about the credibility or the trustworthiness of this thing.
Garbage in, garbage out, biased data in, biased story out.
Exactly. And when you get into the questions of security and bots that might be generating financial stories, if the data stream is hacked in some way or otherwise subverted, would that then affect the content that's generated by the algorithm? And in turn, could that content perhaps affect markets if that data quality were skewed in a particular way?
Can we peek over the horizon and see anything like robotic news judgment?
There have been systems, prototype systems that have been developed that have looked at generating summaries of sporting events using online media data. And what they'll do is they'll actually try and create a different perspective on the same event to sort of show what is a summary of this game from one particular team's point of view versus what is the summary of that same game from a different team's point of view. You could imagine this algorithm as embodying two different sets of potential editorial criteria where it's trying to cover one perspective versus another.
A Fox algorithm and an MSNBC algorithm reporting on the same event, yielding very different stories.
Absolutely.
Now, you're not just some Eisenhower saying beware of the publisher software complex. You are actually yourself going into algorithms, reverse engineering them to understand how they might, for example, bias or censor the news. How are you doing that?
If you imagine the way a biologist studies a cell, they would poke it 1,000 times and see what happens to that cell. You can sort of poke and prod an algorithm not 100 or even 1,000 times, but 1,000,000 times and see how it reacts. and record both of those prods and the reactions as data and start to hone in on and clarify what some of the editorial criteria of the algorithm might be, how the algorithm might be censoring certain things, if the algorithm is making mistakes that might be consequential, how the algorithm is tuned to perhaps prefer one type of mistake over another type of mistake. Of course, we can't tell everything. You know, to get a more holistic view of how an algorithm is operating, talking to the designers of the algorithms, finding out what kinds of design decisions were made, what the intent was of the design, and so on. And I think by sort of combining that human-level understanding of the social system that gave rise to the algorithm with the sort of reverse engineering approach can start to really help us clarify how those algorithms are operating.
Today, to confront a story that is flawed, we rely on truth squatters and media critics to locate individual errors of omission and commission and so forth. But you're actually envisioning being able to go into the central consciousness that creates a story and maybe head off any bias problems at creation.
I don't actually believe that bias is a problem that can be corrected. I think it's something that we can be aware of. To the broader issue of using algorithms to articulate bias, there's a very interesting project going on at the Data and Society Research Institute in New York where they're looking at using bots as almost like a heat-seeking missile against misinformation. So you can imagine a lot of people on Twitter are out there tweeting about how vaccines cause autism. Now, this is something that's been debunked in the mainstream scientific literature, yet the meme sort of persists online. And so what this researcher, Tim Huang, is doing is thinking about how you could almost create a bot army to go out and recognize misinformation and then have the bot army suggest that they might be wrong and that they should look at some other news story on this subject or some other science on the subject, and almost creating an immune system of algorithms. Now, of course, this opens all kinds of other questions.
Oh, it certainly does, not the least of which is that immune systems are subject to the mutation of viruses. Mm. So wouldn't your bot armies of truth be confronted with perhaps larger bot armies of falsity?
Yeah, we really are sort of heading toward this Star Wars future, aren't we, where wars are waged with bots, and perhaps the war of ideas will also be waged with bots. Look, we don't really know where this is all heading, and some of these ideas are still in the research labs. It's refreshing to me that people are experimenting with this and trying different things. Perhaps people will become hardened. Perhaps there's other strategies that would actually get them to moderate their views to some extent.
Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Diakopoulos is a Tau Fellow at the Columbia School of Journalism.
Coming up, the magical, mysterious world of internet governance.
Scott died, unfortunately, in 1998, around the same time. He handed over control of DNS to an organization called ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Signed Names and Numbers.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Many marked the web's 25th anniversary this month, celebrations occasioned by the anniversary of a paper written by web founding father Tim Berners-Lee while a fellow at the European Particle Physics Lab, CERN. His paper, snappily titled Information Management, A Proposal, imagined an internet-based system whereby scientists working around the world could share data and results. Back in 1989, Berners-Lee already had a clear vision of what the web should be, quote, "The system must allow any sort of information to be entered. Another person must be able to find the information, sometimes without knowing what he's looking for." He described the importance of links, the value of connecting previously unconnected databases, and allowing anyone access to the system from anywhere. In other words, everything we take for granted.
If Berners-Lee's paper is elegant, the actual business of running the web seems numbingly dull all schematics and acronyms. But last week, this arcane work actually grabbed the headlines when the United States agreed to surrender its last bit of control over the governance of the web. You might think of the web as being, well, altogether worldwide, but having bankrolled its early development, the U.S. Department of Commerce has retained a vestigial link to its operation and regulation. Increasingly, and especially in the wake of NSA revelations, America's role has engendered suspicion. And so, last week, the government decided to cut its ties with the California-based nonprofit called ICANN that makes the web work by safeguarding the domain name system, or DNS. DNS ensures that what you type in the address bar gets you to the location you're looking for. But when the U.S. decided to step away from its supervisory role of ICANN, critics on the political right cried foul. Here's Fox News host and former presidential hopeful Mike Huckabee.
People want to use our ideas? Fine. We'll share them. But we're going to own them, because if we develop it, then it's ours. And if you, you know, want to accept that, fine. If you don't, then develop your own internet and spend the resources to do it.
Brendan Greeley is a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for talking about internet governance.
Yeah, what were the odds? DNS, domain name registry. Explain, please.
All right. So when you type in a URL into your web browser, businessweek.com, say, your computer consults a master list that says this URL connect with the following servers. If you're in Mumbai or if you're in New York City, you get the same servers. It is what makes the web universal. It's just a piece of plumbing that is incredibly important, so important that the first man who was in charge of this earned the nickname God. God died, unfortunately, in 1998. And around the same time, he handed over control of DNS to an organization called ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Signed Names and Numbers. It's a nonprofit. It's operated out of California. Now, ICANN is sort of impenetrable organization. It's very difficult to figure out exactly how it works. No single company, no single country, no groups of countries are in charge of it. In theory, the board reflects decisions that are made through consultation with corporations and states and civil society actors.
So they have a lot of constituencies. And till now, they've kept those constituencies pretty happy, right? I'm not aware of a whole bunch of complaints about how URLs resolve online.
Bob, that is because you don't spend a lot of time watching internet governance. They have kept everybody sort of equally dissatisfied. Certain countries don't want certain URLs to appear.
So if you're China, for example, and you don't want traffic in ideas concerning a independent Tibet, you don't want to see independenttibet.com as a URL.
Precisely. The basic protections that have been so important for the internet, the assumption of free speech that you have a right to register a new domain name, that's been protected. And that was part of the goal of the original contract with ICANN. The concern has always been that if there isn't at least a basic contract with the U.S. stating what the goals of the domain name system should be, that ICANN will eventually start to stray from those goals.
Okay, well, before we get to that, though, Brendan, why would the government cede any authority that it retains on the internet?
No country cedes sovereignty when it doesn't have to. The problem with the internet is that you have to get everybody to agree to do the same thing. In the last decade, it has become harder and harder to get everybody to agree to do the same thing if that same thing is ultimately owned by the United States. Even if the contract with Commerce didn't have anything to do with the day-to-day workings of ICANN, the fact that the U.S. was in control of this ultimately legally made it harder to negotiate with other countries. It is very likely that it was accelerated by last year's revelations about NSA spying.
The notion of the U.S. government doing anything that even remotely looks like surrendering sovereignty, however, is bound to stir up anxiety, especially on the political right, particularly ceding authority to some sort of murky global authority.
You have heard several people on the right say something like ceding sovereignty unilaterally is like giving up the Panama Canal. I think there is a genuine concern that ICANN, on its own, does not have the institutional strength to withstand countries like China and Russia. I think that's legitimate. The problem is, if you're the U.S., you have to ask yourself a question. Do you want to be sovereignly awesome, or do you want to be effective? The reason they let go of the contract is because it became clear that holding on to this right was no longer doing them any good in international negotiations. U.S. control of ICANN through commerce had become a liability in getting the U.S. what it wanted out of ICANN.
And it's dealing with rival states, notably China and Russia, Iran, that have very different notions of what constitutes basic human rights, like free speech. Should we fear that countries that heavily censor the internet will try to exert control over ICANN in the absence of U.S. government authority?
I think we should fear that. There's been a movement among several countries, China and Russia prominent among them, to take the authority that ICANN had through commerce and move it to the UN through a body called the International Telecommunications Union. What this would mean is it would replace the approach that ICANN has had, which is everything takes forever because you've got to get civil society actors on board, you've got to get corporations on board, you have to get consensus over a number of countries. Replace the stakeholder approach with the UN approach, which is you got a bunch of countries, countries vote their interests. So the fear is that over time, ICANN will become something more UN-like. I think the worst case outcome would be that over the long term, ICANN becomes an organization where you have one state, one vote.
900-pound superpower gorillas taking disproportionate control of the internet. That's one nightmare scenario. Another is a kind of repeat of the 60s and the non-aligned movement, where a lot of different countries band together to use the internet as a way to aggregate political strength. Is that a risk under the new governance infrastructure compared to the status quo?
So far, ICANN has been able to prevent that. Long term, I think the risk is a slight eroding of this process where everybody agrees and countries don't get their own way. One way that we've already seen this, for example, has been the introduction of internationalized domain names, which allow you to register a domain name in Mandarin or in Hindi or in Cyrillic characters. These are incredibly important because there's a limited number of people in any country that speak English and can read websites in Latin characters. Once you expand the character base, then you expand the readership. So China is hyper-focused on making sure that it has control over domain names that are produced in Mandarin, for example. In order to do that, you have to go through a government, which means that in this decision, the principle of sovereignty was the most important one. So it's a very real risk, but the risk is not that a single country or group of countries takes over the internet. The risk is that they take their internet and they go home.
I guess to end this, Brandon, earlier we discussed the idea that the original arbiter of what the rules of the internet would be, he was nicknamed God. It was a monotheistic system. Have we now gone to online polytheism? Is that our future?
I think the best hope for a single internet is that the internet continues to follow its one true religion, which is trade, that corporations continue to recognize that their best interest lies in selling to as many people in as many different places as possible. Trust and greed, I think, is the best hope we have.
You are so business week.
Money talks, and hopefully it will continue to.
All right, Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brandon Greeley is a staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek.
Greeley described ICANN as impenetrable, and so it is, especially since 2010 when it began to implement a confoundingly complex system to protect the security of its domain names. The people with the key to the system meet quarterly on the East Coast and then the West Coast under the eye of a pack of observers. They met most recently on February 13th in a Los Angeles suburb. The Guardian's James Ball was among them.
We heard there are seven people scattered around the world with some master key to the internet that could switch it off or restart it in the case of nuclear war or something like that. What then happens is essentially there's this really long 100-step scripted plan, this ritual which is to renew a key at the core of the internet.
To penetrate the fortress requires a series of IDs, security cards, handprints, even scans of the participants' irises.
Please center your eyes in the mirror. please move a little back from the camera? Sorry, we cannot confirm your identity.
The whole point is to ensure the security of the DNS system, the backbone of trust on the web, and reassure us that in our virtual travels, we will neither be hijacked or blocked. Or if we are blocked, at least we'll know it. It all boils down to protecting a line of code, a digital master key. So ICANN devised a set of smart cards to activate it that are locked in a series of safety deposit boxes inside a safe. Those key holders, mostly computer security geeks, each hold a physical key to one of those safety deposit boxes. Still with me?
So they have a key to a safety deposit box, which is inside a safe that they can't open, which is inside an insanely high secure facility, which they hopefully can't get into. So the person who knows the combination for the safe can't get in the room and can't get in the facility. The people who have the actual keys can't get anywhere, and the people who can get in the room don't know the combination or have the key. So, I mean, it does sound like something out of Ocean's 11.
There's even a procedure to get into the canteen.
You kind of have to present yourself, give your ID, and then someone takes you and puts his handprint in and a very long code, and this kind of door slides open. And you have to go into this room, which is completely featureless. It's about sort of 10-foot square. And the door shuts behind you and you're sealed in. And then he has to do exactly the same again on another door to let you out. And they do another couple of tests. You've got to have a smart card and another handprint. And that gets you to the break room. At this point, you can drink a bit of soda or play on an arcade machine.
Getting into the room where the key ceremony actually is held demands a whole new round of security, which gets you into a small room split into three small mesh cages, one of which is off to the side and contains two huge safes. Ball couldn't get into that one, but he could see it from his cage. That room was just for the chosen key holders, and not all seven. Three of them are there just for backup.
And so they had four of these seven people with the keys to the internet, the kind of guy who is running the ceremony, and one of two people in the world that knows the code to one of the safes. And they're in this tiny 8-foot by 8-foot cage, and they slam the safe door. And it turns out one of the many security procedures they have is a seismic sensor, which disables all the door locks. Suddenly they've locked the key holders to the internet inside this cage. I was at least trapped in a bigger room, and someone had very considerately brought some snacks, so at this point we're all eating Oreos and wondering how they're going to get them out of the cage. They worked out the only way they could do it was to trigger a building evacuation.
After that little diversion, the ceremony resumed.
Each of the key holders hands over their smart card to the person running the ceremony, and they put them in turn into this machine. And after it's had three of the seven, it's activated. And then it's just one quick line of code, and it renews the key for another 3 months.
This summer on the East Coast, they'll do it all over again. This process, launched by ICANN in 2010, this transition to a single master key, protected by keys, within keys, will take a few more years to roll out.
There's really no other security system in the world that leans back on just one key. This is about the one place in the world. It's the first time they've tried it. And they're really, really trying to make people believe that no one controls it. That's what this whole kind of theatre's about. They're trying to say, hey, check it out. We've got all of these steps. There is no way the US has this secret backdoor into it. There's no way the NSA does. There's no way Russia does. We can only use it for what we're saying we use it for.
One key that can signal users that a website is blocked and indicate when a site is a sham. A single system for a worldwide web, a bold effort straining against the ill will generated by those NSA revelations, but still moving forward.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Mira Sharma. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week is Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.